Welcome to Logical with Ludmila, where we untangle the legal knots so that you don't have to. I'm Ludmila Yamalova, a U.S. qualified lawyer based in Dubai. And in each episode, we break down complex law into clear, practical insights that you can actually use. Today, we're diving into a landmark update in the UAE law, the new personal status law, which is the federal decree law number 41 of 2024, which took effect on April 15th, 2025, so just a few months ago. It replaces a 2005 law, think about it, 2005 law, which is a 20-year-old law, and reshapes how family matters are legally handled in the UAE. By family matters, we mean marriages, divorces, inheritance, alimony, and so on, for Muslims and non-Muslims alike. Now, I have to warn you ahead of time, this is going to be a fairly meaty discussion or monologue, perhaps, rather, or podcast. And that's because we're talking about a very dense and a very detailed law. So we're talking about, as I just earlier said, all of the different aspects of a personal law, which starts with marriages and ends ultimately with death. As a result, there is a lot of sections in the law at the risk of making this podcast perhaps too mundane or too legalese or too boring or too sort of inaccessible or uninteresting, I'm going to cover some of the main topics to an extent, but perhaps not drill down too much because otherwise we'd need to perhaps have a 10-hour long podcast. But these are certainly important matters, and they're especially important because in the UAE, each one of them has different angles and nuances. So, for example, marriages, engagements, I mean, subjects that perhaps in other jurisdictions are just much more clear-cut in the UAE because of the religious, historical, cultural, and legal dimensions. Each one of these concepts is a lot more complex in terms of the laws themselves and the different principles that are involved. I just kind of give you a little bit of a sort of an advanced look or heads up in terms of what we're going to be talking about. So once we talk about kind of the overview of the law, then we'll discuss marriages and engagements and what sort of the new personal status law covers or how it discusses or defines those two specific terms. And remember, we're talking marriages and engagement. In most other jurisdictions, engagement's not really kind of a subject, a legal discussion, but here it actually is quite a bit of a concept. We'll also talk about sort of judicial approval for marriages. Again, in other jurisdictions, this may not be much of a legal principle that would otherwise be codified in the law, but in the UAE under the personal status law in particular, so judicial approval for marriages is a concept that has always been prevalent in this legislation and this jurisdiction, and therefore still is in the law and deserves its own space. And then we talk about Muslim women and guardianship and what that means, and then Muslim residents and their legal choice in terms of which law to apply. We'll also talk about jurisdiction and scope of this law, which is quite an interesting subject in and of itself because it leads to creates a lot of misinformation and confusion about who this law actually applies to. And actually has much broader application that some may think. And then we'll talk about custody and guardianship and in particular age versus child's best interest, perhaps one of the biggest changes in the law. Then we'll talk about the choice of custodians and the end of custody, and then just the basic requirements and elements for custody and including termination or end of custody. Then we'll talk about even things that, again, are specifically of specific sort of interest in this part of the world, like documents. Who has the right to keep documents? Perhaps other jurisdictions, less of a topic, but here actually does come up quite often. And so there's a whole section in the law that deals with that. We'll also talk about child support and alimony to wife, as well as asset division, and ultimately inheritance and wills. We start with birth and end with death, and then ultimately also proving of lineage. So there's a brief provision that deserves a little bit of attention too. That's the overview, the outline for today's podcast. So as I mentioned earlier, it is a fairly meaty subject, much to cover. And it took me quite some time to prepare myself to record this because there's so many different nuances, so many different variables, so many different family dimensions that we deal with, and that this this country usually kind of attracts by virtue of being so diverse and so inclusive. First I thought about doing it and recording it on the basis of specific examples of family sort of structures, but there's just too many different examples. There's too many different nuances. So what I think I would have finally decided, I'll just give you, this podcast focus on just kind of a structure of the law and kind of high level overview of the law. And then as time goes on, if it becomes of more relevance or interest, we'll maybe drill down on some specific examples of how this law would be applied for specific kinds of family structures. So now let's start with the overview of the law itself. It's a big deal. Now, it's a big deal, as I mentioned earlier, because this particular law that was just issued not long ago, last year, but only comes into effect now in 2025, as I said earlier, basically April 15th, 2025. It replaces what a previous law, which had been in existence for more than 20 years. So it's a fairly significant transformation or legal transformation of the UAE personal status law. So until this law was introduced, and again, this the law we're talking about is the federal decree law number 41 of 2024. And this is, for those who are not aware, just to kind of reiterate the point, it is a federal law. So it's a law that applies to all of the UAE, to all of the Emirates, all seven of the Emirates. So it's not an Emirate-based law. It's a national law. So this law replaced the previous law, which was law number 28 of 2005, which, as I mentioned earlier, had governed personal status matters in the UAE for more than 20 years. So the law itself, in terms of who it applies to, by default, applies to all UAE citizens and residents, and even non-residents in some cases. And it covers marriages, divorces, custody, guardianship, alimony, inheritance, and ultimately wills and probate. And at a high level, the law reflects a shift towards a more progressive legal framework and sort of balancing traditional Sharia principles with modern civil practices. By default, and I sort of highlight this word, by default, this law applies to Muslims and non-Muslims by default. But non-Muslims and some Muslims, that's why I said I highlight that by default, but there's a lot of caveats. But non-Muslims and some Muslims can actually opt for an alternative law. So in other words, they can opt out of this law and choose a different law to apply to them. And we'll talk about that shortly in terms of jurisdiction and scope of the law. In terms of perhaps the more transformative, substantive changes in the law, they could be categorized as follows. I mean, one is it's a more kind of a gender-neutral divorce provision. So there's an additional options for divorce that make it a little easier for women to apply for a divorce than perhaps would have been the case under the previous law. Then also the custody decisions that are based now on interests of the child and not fixed age. And this is perhaps one of the most transformative and substantive changes in the law for a lot of families who live in the UAE, because until this law was introduced, custody in particular was very much defined based on the child's age. So now that all those provisions are just no more, they're no longer in the law. And now the focus is what is in the best interest of the child. And that's how custody is now decided. And then the third, fairly transformative, provisions in the law. We'll have to see how it applies in practice, because as I mentioned, again, the law only kicked in April 15th, so that's just about a month and a half ago. So we have not seen this specific law be applied yet to this extent. But one interesting change to be on the lookout for is an equitable asset division. So in recognizing spouse's contribution during the marriage. So in other words, and we'll talk about it in more detail shortly, but in other words, now there is a way for a spouse to claim compensation for her contribution, particularly for a wife, to claim contribution or compensation for the contribution that she would have invested into the family dynamic over the years of marriage, which are not just financial in nature. And again, we'll go through the details shortly. Okay, so now let's start with the main one. Now it's starting kind of this. Remember, we're talking about personal status law, so personal. personal matters. So where does the personal matters begin with? Well, engagements and marriages. So the law has a number of provisions that deal specifically with engagements, you know, starting with engagements and marriages. And it's quite interesting. The engagements is in sort of the Middle East in general, engagements is a big deal. It's almost like a marriage. It's almost like a contract. And so there's specific provisions in the law that deal with that. And in particular, for example, obligations between the parties when they break up the engagement. And the reason the law is so specific about that is because it's much more customary and culturally kind of accepted for couples before they tie the knot, choose to go through this engagement process, which is not your typical kind of engagement that you would see in the West, which is between the two parties. Here, it's the families involved, and it's basically, it's kind of like an almost like an informal contract to be married, an informal contract. As part of this step in the relationship, there's a lot of gifts and money that sort of the flows from the groom or from the from fiance to his fiance. You know, in the Middle East, this is a fairly well-to-do region. So some of these gifts and presents are quite expensive in value. So now there's whole provisions in the law that deal with, for example, in the event the woman decides to break off the engagement. So there's an obligation, and again, under certain circumstances, an obligation to return some of the gifts, some of the more expensive gifts, unless they are clearly sort of were given as gifts without strings attached. So the law has a number of provisions that deal with just engagement, so it's quite interesting and very sort of culturally based. And there's kind of generate a lot of discussion within the team here because although I've been in the region for so long, it didn't really occur to me what a sort of important concept in of itself in its own right it is in the culture and therefore now sort of in the law. So certainly, and apparently, there's a lot of legal disputes that exist just on the basis of these engagements and broken engagements and expectations during the engagement. So now with this law, the previous law did not really delve into this particular topic to this level of detail. So now for all those, and apparently there's many of them, for all those couples that go through engagements and may find issues with them, now they have a specific source of law that they can refer back to and help sort of manage and maneuver their relationship or end of their relationship. So that's engagement, right? Then we go to marriages. Then the law talks, there's quite a bit of nuances to the marriage itself. Was previously the case, the minimum marriage in the UAE is 18. So, and that was also the case under the previous law, although the previous law had been kind of amended, and brought the minimum age for marriage as 18 a few years ago. So now it is possible to also get married below the age of 18, but it requires court approval. So this is an important element. So there is a specific provision that does allow for kind of earlier marriage, but it certainly requires a court approval, which is great because in the past, from what we know, is sort of these kinds of marriages of much younger girls were more customary. So now they're not necessarily illegal, but they do require supervision from the courts. There's another third kind of aspect of marriage, and that's a category of marriage. And if a never married woman is marrying someone who is more than 30 years senior or older than her, so that's an interesting kind of category. So it's like a separate category of marriages. In other words, once again, so a woman that's marrying somebody who is much older than her, that's 30 plus years, but it's not just that alone. It's just that this woman has never been married before. So that's a category. It's not just someone. It's not the age per se, it's also ultimately someone who is very young and has never been previously married, and so now they're marrying somebody much older than them. So now, as per the law, that kind of marriage again is legal, but it requires approval from the judge. And so that specific provision is a specific provision that Article 19 that deals with that. So that's that. So those three types of marriages: marriage below 18, so marriage minimum age is 18. Marriage below 18 requires approval of the judge, and a woman has never been married before that's marrying somebody much older, that's 30 years or more senior to her, also requires approval by the judge. Then judicial approval for marriage. So if for Muslim families or for Muslim marriages, historically, and this is sort of governed by the principles of Sharia, is that they require for a Muslim woman to marry, they require approval of a guardian. So as per the current law, which is quite transformative for a lot of Muslim women who live in the region, as we have heard, so if a guardian refuses to approve a marriage, then the court must approve it. And the court must approve it based solely on the woman's will and acceptance of dowry. Now, this is a much more loaded term than it may appear. Why? Because in the past, the law also provided for those circumstances where the woman's guardian may not give his consent to marriage. And then, so in those cases, the law did provide that there was an option for to appeal to the judge, and the judge basically would have the option of stepping in or acting as a guardian. But the way the law was drafted, it was an option for a judge to do so. And in many cases, what we observed in our practice that a lot of the times the judges did not want to take, to kind of overstep the guardian's decision and had applied their own discretion, and in many cases just kind of refused to take the place of the guardian. So kind of in simpler terms, why this is an important element, and this we have seen this in our practice, is that, for example, we have an Emirati woman who wants to marry an American man, and these examples that we have dealt with in our own practice. And the father of the woman, who's obviously the Emirati, just did not want to give approval, although the couple had gone through all of the kind of protocols and requirements for the man to make sure that you had to convert and to do all the kind of religious training and all the paperwork and certificates and everything. They tried to do everything by the book, and they really wanted to live in the UAE. And so the father basically just kind of refused. Refused to give consent and therefore act as a guardian, and that without that the marriage cannot go through. And in this case, both the man and the woman, the professional, they're working. So that's one of the perhaps discretions that at least theoretically judges would usually use it. And this is also the kind of the test that the judges will look at in terms of whether the guardian had the right or reason to withdraw or to deny his consent for the daughter to marry. Is like, well, can this man take care of her? Can he also be a good Muslim husband and then therefore father to the children? And so in this case, in our client's case, all the boxes were ticked. So they're a professional couple, well-to-do, sort of well-traveled, and so did everything by the book. But for whatever reason, the father just did not want, perhaps of cultural differences, did not want approved marriage. And so the couple appealed to the judge and asked for the judge to step in and act as a guardian. And so the judge, perhaps for cultural reasons, it did not feel comfortable overstepping the father's kind of decision, and did not offer his services as a guardian, so the couple could not get married in the UAE. Now, as per the new law, as per the old law, that was allowed. As per the new law, the way it's drafted is that it's not for the judge's discretion. So, and the law says that the court must approve. If it's just based on solely on the woman's will of wanting to take this man as her husband and her acceptance of the dowry. So if the woman says, yes, I want to marry such and such, and yes, he's offered a dowry, I accept it, or whatever the dowry may be, then the language in the law is that the court must approve. This is quite transformative because at least as the text of the law does not leave it up to the judge to decide. So it's just procedural and not discretionary. So this is quite an interesting development. And I would obviously this will do more updates on the specific topic as time goes on, once we see how judges start implementing the law in practice. So with regards to a woman who wants to apply to get married, and so the marriage application can be submitted by the woman herself as well and by her future husband, so it doesn't need to now be done by just the husband. So it can be applied by the woman, but also can be the application, that is, right? It can also be applied by law. This is by not just her future husband, but also by the mother, sister, or brother. So that's, I think, in terms of procedure, there are different ways for the marriage application to be submitted. With regards to this, the approval, the guardian approval for marriage, it applies to UAE citizens and to certain UAE residents, and we'll go through which of the residents, but it certainly applies to to Muslim UAE citizens. Okay, so that's kind of the requirement that you UAE nationals cannot sidestep and cannot opt out of. So Muslim women and guardianship. So Muslim women who are not UAE citizens, this is very, very interesting and quite helpful to many. So they no longer need a guardian's approval to marry if the home country's law does not require a guardian's approval. So this is, I dare say this, huge for a lot of Muslim women. And this is because until this new personal status law was introduced, the default application of the UAE personal status law was that it applied to all Muslims, irrespective of their nationality. And the Muslims could not opt out of it. So whether you're an American family or couple, or an English or Australian woman or a couple, it does not matter. So you just by virtue of you being Muslim, you were exclusively bound to this UAE personal status law, which in other terms, among other things, required guardian's approval to marry. So let's get an example of an American woman that wants to marry a man, say a Muslim man, maybe another Muslim American man in the UAE. So in the past, under the previous law, she would have again required consent or her guardian's approval. Now, for a lot of the times, it's not even so much first of all, for a lot of people kind of from the West, parents don't usually get involved in providing their approval. So that's a concept that's difficult, sometimes difficult for them to transport across the oceans, not just culturally, but certainly even practical terms. And so we've had many of those cases where it just was impractical for the father to come and give consent. Because the countries are so far apart. So in the past, there was no other choice but to get married with the approval of the guardian, who might have been in other countries. And this is why, by the way, a lot of couples like that chose to get married elsewhere just because it was easier, because they didn't have to have their father, in most cases the father of the bride, to have to travel to provide his consent to the marriage. So now, as for the new law, if let's say that same American woman, if her law, because she's a U.S. citizen, so if her law does not require for her to obtain guardian's approval, then as per the UAE personal status law, the new law, she no longer requires that guardian's approval. So that's quite huge, because there's a lot of Muslims that live in the UAE that ultimately have come, maybe were born, raised in other countries and have nationality of other countries. So as long as the laws of those countries do not require them to have consent of their guardian to get married, they now can opt out of this aspect of the UAE personal law. But it's quite interesting, it's this very UAE personal law that gives the option of opting out of this particular requirement. I guess another specific example is that's a little closer to home, like a Jordanian Muslim, may apply Jordanian law or opt into like Abu Dhabi. Abu Dhabi's law. So there's so many different interesting aspects, but the more specific example, apart from the American couple, another Muslim country. So like a Muslim woman from Tunisia may marry in the UAE without her guardian's consent, because in Tunisia, Muslim women do not require consent of the guardian. So you see, we're not just talking about the laws of the countries from across the ocean. It's also even in the region closer to home. Different countries have different laws. So that's with regards to the consent of the guardian to get married. We're still sort of on the subject of marriage. Now, With regards to sort of the Muslim residents and the choice of which law to apply, now Muslim residents, not citizens, and this is quite important, so this applies to only Muslim residents who have nationality from other countries, who are not UAE nationals. Now they can also apply the law of their home country or their chosen sort of legal framework, away from basically principles of Sharia. This is another fundamental shift in the personal status law, because until this law came into effect, the default application to all Muslims in the UAE was this UAE, the previous UAE personal status law, and they could not opt out of it. They could not, for example, benefit or try to benefit from the laws of their home country. Now they can specifically, and that going back to that same example, for example, of a French woman who's Muslim, or a French couple that's Muslim. Now, as well, they, instead of applying in the case of custody or divorce or even inheritance, in case they want to apply the law of their home country, they now can do so, even though they're Muslim, because the new personal status law basically allows them to opt, the specific provision allows them to opt out from the specific requirement. I guess another example is this, as I mentioned earlier, Jordanian Muslim man may now apply Jordanian law to his marriage or divorce or any aspects of the personal relationship. So may either request that, or, by the way, can opt into another law of the UAE. So, and the UAE has, and I've done podcasts on this subject, there's so many different laws, but there's also, for example, a civil law in the UAE. So it's also the law that ultimately it's a personal status law, but based on sort of civil principles of marriage. It's called the Civil Marriages and Its Effects Law. So now, as per this law, the same, let's say, Jordanian Muslim couple or a person, man or woman, they have a choice of either applying this UAE personal status law, which is based on principles of Sharia, or they can opt to apply their own, let's say, Jordanian law, or they can opt for another law of the country, the UAE, that is, which is the civil law. We have two different types of civil laws. We have one in Abu Dhabi and one at the federal level, and they're both effective. So unlike the previous law, now that same Muslim couple has the benefit of a choice of at least three different laws versus just one sort of Sharia-based law. So that's on the Muslim residence and legal choice. And now, with regards to sort of jurisdiction and scope, this is very interesting, and this is I keep getting reminded, because so many clients come to us and shake their heads and like, no, this is not possible. But in fact, it is. And that is in terms of, to whom does this law apply? And there's a lot of controversy, and that, which obviously stems from kind of, I don't know, dare I say, ignorance of the law, who does this law apply? Because those who have lived in the UAE would know that so many of us are here from literally all walks of life. You could have, a Muslim person that's, you know, has Russian nationality, that's married to a Pakistani, Muslim person that has a British nationality, or, you know, a German national that's married to somebody from Rwanda, and maybe she could be Muslim from Rwanda and he is Christian from Germany, and so on and so forth. There's so many different dynamics of personal relationships here. So that's basically one side of it. The other side is that because for many of us here, we're expats, right? Which means we usually have another home somewhere, if not multiple homes. And so what often happens is that couples either get married here and then one of them leaves, or one of them has residency here and the other one doesn't. In many people's cases, they believe that, or many, I guess, believe that this law does not have kind of narrow application, and only to people that are either physically in the UAE and sometimes even more narrow application. That is like that they basically cannot be subject to laws of other countries in order for them to be subject to jurisdiction here. Believe it or not, I mean, there's that many. There's that much sort of confusion or misunderstanding about the jurisdiction itself. So now let me give you a few specific examples. So the law is actually has very broad, very wide application. So first of all, it applies to all UAE Muslim citizens without exception. So this is a very important point to highlight, is that while the law is very, sort of detailed and sort of flexible in terms of offering options to other Muslim residents in terms of choice of, you know, which parts of this law they wish to apply and which laws they may wish to opt out of, there's no such flexibility or freedom that's offered to to UAE nationals. So UAE nationals are Muslim nationals are basically exclusively subject to this law and they cannot opt out of it. So those examples when I said that somebody can, you know, a Muslim couple can get married under civil marriages law, like that does not apply to UAE nationals. So then the law applies by default is to mixed faith marriages involving one Muslim party. So for example, an Emirati Muslim man, you know, marrying a Christian spouse. So by law, or by default, the law applies to those couples as well. But depending on what sort of mixed faith marriage they are, they may be able, as long as they're not Emiratis, they can opt out of this law in favor of their home country's law. These days we also have non-Muslim UAE citizens, and this is why I wanted to highlight that specific difference. Is that and then we've actually even seen the laws being changed, the language of the laws, of new laws being changed quite quickly, exactly to encompass or address that very nuance. That is a fairly recent thing, and that is that now there's more UAE nationals who have UAE nationality, but who are not Muslims. So, for example, there's Russians, there's Chinese, you know, there's Americans. American, Indian nationals, I guess previously, so who also have UAE nationality. So now the law does not expect for those UAE nationals who are not Muslims to be subject to this law. Because remember, this particular law is based fundamentally on principles of Sharia. So, but we also have a civil marriages law as well. So there's an option for non-Muslims, non-Muslim nationals to basically to choose which law. So therefore, as per this law, the non-Muslim UAE citizens, they can choose either a religious law, let's say if it's the Hindu, so they can choose their own religious law, or they can choose another foreign law, let's say they want to choose English law, or they can opt for this personal status law. So they have an option, and so this is in connection with UAE citizens who are not Muslims. Now they have at least these three different choices. They can either opt for this law, they can opt for a different religious law, or they can opt for their own sort of country's law. This is kind of where I wanted to clarify, is that often, in many cases, non-residents may also be covered by this law. So in other words, this law may apply to somebody who is not a UAE resident, and that is in the following cases. One, if a spouse is one of the spouses is a UAE citizen or UAE resident. So let me give an example. So two expats who lived in Dubai and are now abroad, or let's say the wife left and the husband stayed. The husband wants to divorce the wife. So even though she's no longer in the UAE and she might have even given up her UAE residency, this law will still apply to her, because at least one of the spouses is still a UAE resident. So the law by default applies. Now, there could be other competing laws, and then it will be up to the courts where the specific case might be argued to decide which court perhaps have more grounds for jurisdiction. But by default, this law would also apply to these kinds of couples, even if as long as one of them still is a UAE resident or has kind of or claims UAE as their base or the place of residence. So for example, you have a couple, let's call them an Australian couple, that have a home in the UAE but don't have residency, or they're a habitual sort of residence here. They come and they rent a property here. They don't even own anything here, but they rent, for example, long-term hotel accommodation and stay here on a regular basis. So this also, they would also be subject to this law, because the way the courts would look at them is that they basically claiming UAE as their place of residence. So even though they don't have official residency, because they spend enough time in the UAE to kind of establish connection to the country, therefore this law, by virtue of this law, this country and the courts here, by virtue of this law, would also have jurisdiction over them. Okay, so that's about we've discussed the marriages, engagements, and I guess there are different sort of nuances and requirements for marriages, and also scope and jurisdiction. Now let's talk about more specific parts of personal relationships. So one is obviously, so once we marry, right, then in most cases, before we go to the divorce, let's hope that there is children involved. So I guess maybe I shouldn't say let's hope, but let's kind of, I guess the idea of people get married so that they can go through this progression of then having children. And I guess most people don't get married to divorce. So let's start, let's discuss this in that sequence of events. So after the marriage, we have the issue of custody. And custody can come up in different ways. You know, custody can also come up even before the divorce, to be honest with you. So the people can just want to, maybe a couple just be separated and not officially divorced. So now the default custody goes to the mother for boys and girls until the age of 15. So this is quite transformative as well. And that's because until the previous law, the custody would end, the mother's custody would end when the boys would reach the age of 11 and girls would reach the age of 13. So now the law, basically those kind of provisions in the law that specifically divided custody into boys and girls and set specific age limits are just no more. They're not even mention of the law, in the law of these kinds of principles. Instead, the law is very clear that the default custody now goes to the mother for both boys and girls until the age of 15. So this is huge, because in the past a lot of disputes, I guess, arise in connection with couples going their separate ways, divorcing, and then obviously there's children. So you have, let's say, an 11-year-old boy or maybe a 11-year-old girl and a 12-year-old boy, and so the boy would, legally speaking, the custody would transfer to the father, and the girl is only a year younger, so she would stay with the mother. So separating the kids, and although the laws previous law had provided for that, in practice the courts often exercise discretion and usually kind of stayed away from separating children, and still they still had discretion, and often they did apply this discretion to keep the children together for obviously the benefit of the children, the kind of family unity. But the law clearly set requirements, so if the father wanted to challenge custody, and so obviously legally he had the right to do so. Now there's it's clearly just this one age category, and this is 15, and it applies to all genders, to both genders, so there's no longer an issue. And then at the age of 15, it kind of gets further. At the age of 15, the custody does not automatically transfer from one parent to, from the mother to the father. The custody actually at 15, now the child has the option to decide with which parent to live. So again, this is when I say the age of 15, it's basically kind of minimum age that children stay with the mother. But once they reach the age of 15, it is up to the children to decide whether they want now to go live with the father or they want to continue to live with the mother. So this is, again, a very, very big change in the law that I know a lot of children and sort of parents in the UAE found quite interesting and intriguing, and perhaps positive. So that's you've got the age of 15 by default, mother at the age of 15, children choose, and now at the age of 18, custody ends. So, and that ends for all. So in that specific provision in the law that clearly states that after the children reach the age of 18, there's basically, it's not longer, parents basically don't have the right to kind of fight over who the children live with. It's they legally speaking no longer have custody over them. In other words, the children can now choose to go and live wherever they want to live, if, you know, including living on their own. And then there's a general provision that deals with custody as a concept, and that is that whatever the courts will do is that the courts will do everything that's sort of the determining factor is the best interest of the child, not age-based, but like best interest of the child. So, and that's, you know, obviously to an extent, it relies on subjective factors and discretion, but to another extent, not really, because again, by the age of 15, so it's very clearly that the mother has a default, right to custody. And so, by the way, the custody is has quite a bit of sections in the law, and it, you know, there's article 113, 114, 122, 123. Anyway, so there's many, many different articles. So it's kind of spread out throughout the law in different contexts. Another aspect of custody is when the child and the mother have different religions. And in particular, the subject has been one of much perhaps importance and sort of emotional, I guess, turmoil in some cases. And that's when the mother, for example, is not Muslim, and the child is a result of sort of their marriage. The husband is Muslim, and so therefore, by default, the family is considered Muslim, and the child is considered Muslim. And but the mother never converted. So in the past, under the old law, mothers of different religion could keep Muslim children only until the age of 5. So in other words, let's say Ukrainian mother who has was married to like a Turkish man or a Pakistani man, and they had a child, a girl, and the mother never converted, and so that girl by default is considered to be Muslim, and because the mother, now the couple separated or divorced, and so the girl turned 6 years old, under the old law, she basically, the mother would lose custody because she does not share religion with her Muslim daughter. So what would happen in the past is that often mothers would convert to just basically be able to claim custody of their children, but even then, remember, it was until the age of 11 and 13. So now, as per the new law, this whole restriction about different religion is completely gone. So there's no more mention of this specific restriction. And now instead, any kind of, as I mentioned earlier, principles of custody are all sort of awarded on the basis of child's best interest. So regardless of the religion, whatever it may be, since in this case, like how would you define child's best interest? Well, the rest of the law is quite informative in that sense, right? Because if the law sets custody age as at 15, and so by default to reside with the mother, irrespective of the gender of the child, that sort of indicates to you what the legislators and the rulers of this country believe is in the best interest of the child, right? So that's kind of the default interpretation or extrapolation of the law, is just that obviously it's in the best interest of the child to stay with the mother at least until the age of 15, at which point she can choose where to, or the child decides where he or she wants to reside. So I would say, so even though here it says that custody is awarded based on the best interest of the child, I don't think it's necessarily an issue that the court would have to apply discretion or would apply discretion. I think it's in kind of extrapolating from the rest of the law, the courts would sort of by default determine that it's in the best interest of the child for the child to stay with the mother. And since there's no longer a specific provision that bases or separates custody or delineates custody on the basis of the religion of the mother and the child, so that whole sort of previous notion or principle is basic, no longer applies, no more is of no consequence. Okay, so then we talked previously about the right to choose custodian at the age of 15. So this, this is an important provision for many, a lot more people, I guess, have been quite intrigued by it and excited than sort of we expected. But yeah, so that's it. You know, it's now pretty clear that there's no more segregation, separation between genders and ages. It's after the age of 15, now the child can decide who they live with, and I guess that's also recognition by the legislators that, you know, these days a child who's 15 years old probably can more or less make good decisions for himself and herself. So this is, I think, another one of those positive takeaways from how this law has been transformed and evolved, is basically recognizing the sort of the youth's ability to make their own choices. Just we're specifically codifying in the law that at the age of 15, it's still up to the child to decide who they want to live with, the mother or the father. So now, and as I mentioned earlier, in terms of custody ends, that's, you know, at the age of 18, is just, there should no longer be a discussion or debate between the parents who has custody, because legally speaking, the custody automatically ends at the age of 18 unless the child is disabled. And that's, you know, this is quite interesting because the previous law was kind of a little, it was not as specific about it in terms of, you know, when custody ends. And, you know, it's this whole concept actually may be a lot more important than it appears first. And that's because if the custody ends at 18, what does it mean less for the parents? What does it mean for the child? So it means that the child is now basically independent and can go and live on her by herself or himself. So legally speaking. So that, by the way, remember, the law applies to all, not just UAE residents, but also specifically UAE nationals. So as per this specific law, once a child ends, whether it's boy or girl, once they reach the age of 18, because the custody, which is kind of the legal, the parent's legal obligation, and therefore over the child, and therefore the child's legal kind of obligation to the parents, i.e., they're still under the authority of the parents, it ends at the age of 18, which means that at that point in time, they are free to go and live their own life. So this is actually a concept that is quite a lot of residents in the UAE found very very positive, and actually applies to a lot more people than I first thought it would. Okay, now with regards to sort of custody, and remember, custody is kind of is a physical possession of the child. So since it by default resides with the mother, but there is, you know, the law sort of sets out a few requirements in terms of, okay, so still to be a custodian, there's requirements that need to be met to make sure that sort of custodian serves appropriate role. I mean, one is it has to be at least 18 years of age. So if the child is, you know, born to a mother that's below the age of 18, then she does not, you know, at that point in time, she does not qualify as a custodian. So she needs to be at least 18 years of age. She also be mentally sound. Now, this is an important one because we've seen, obviously, in divorces, a lot of the times there's arguments between the spouses. They're like, well, you know, she's crazy. She's mentally unsound. It's not a subjective decision, right? So for a mother to lose custody, it's not for the husband or ex-husband, or even for the court to be honest with you, to decide, you know, yeah, she's a little bit nutty. No, there has to be objective evidence to show that the person, the mother in this case, for example, is mentally unsound, which means there has to be a medical examination by a professional that clearly says that she's not able, she's mentally not, not of right judgment. Also, the custodian has to be capable of raising and protecting the child. So this perhaps is a little more of a subjective issue, and that is, in some cases, maybe there's no medical conclusion that the mother is unable to take care of the child, but just by virtue of seeing, or, you know, that she's not mentally, so there's no medical conclusion that shows that she's not well mentally. But in terms of how she takes care of the child, maybe this can be determined by the judge and obviously other experts in the field to show that she's not, okay, maybe she's not medically certified, certifiably unwell, but you know, in practical terms, she does not make a good mother and therefore is not fit to protect, to take care of the child because she cannot protect the child. So that's, you know, that particular discussion can still be up to the courts and experts. So there's a few other specific rules that apply to custodians, in this case, mothers. So a mother may not remarry unless the court approves and, you know, not decides that it's in the best interest of the child. So this is an important provision because, the unless part is quite interesting because in the past and the previous law, it was just by default. If the mother has custody and so if she decides to remarry, so then she loses that custody. It was basically, that was a default application. There was no two ways around it. Now the law sort of preserves part of that concept and says a mother may not marry, but it has this unless the court approves in child's best interest. Now, you can see that it's no longer as categorical, unequivocal as it used to be, but it's still, so you could see, and you can also, if you go back to the whole principle of custody, which is it has to be in the best interest of the child, so you could see how it may be, so more often than not that the courts can see that it actually is in the best interest of the child for mother to remarry so that they can provide for the child better, right? So let's say the mother does not work and the new husband does work and can actually provide for the children much better. And so that the court may kind of easily determine that it's still in the best interest of the child for the mother to actually have somebody looking after her. So this is also an important, very important provision. So now in the case of custody by the father, and sometimes that also happens, obviously. So in order for the father to have custody, he must ensure that a female adult is present for the daughter. So that's in the event that he has custody of the daughter. And the female adult could be the sister, could be the mother, in other words. So the courts and the system wants to make sure that if custody, that's the physical possession of the child, is with the father, and then in this case the child is the daughter, that there's a female presence around that can basically take care and look after the interests of the daughter. Some other requirements with custodians is that custodians must not have a criminal record involving any kind of conducts of dishonor. They must not have substance abuse problems, which is very important. We've seen examples of that in our practice. So there is, custodians can lose basically custody if they have substance abuse problems. And one of the other sort of limitations to custody with a caveat is just that they must not be of a different religion unless the court deems otherwise. So all of this sort of the custody and the requirements for custody is they're codified in Article 113 for those who are curious. So now let me kind of wrap up the idea of custody and guardianship. And so this concept that exists under Sharia in particular is that custody is the physical possession of the child. And that's what we talked about is who does which parent and has the right to expect for the child or the children to live with them. And that's basically custody. So but under Sharia, so you've got concept of custody and you have guardianship. So guardianship is basically a legal right over the child. And so but with right comes also responsibility. So and that is by default, guardianship is usually with the father. And the obligations that come with guardianship is that the father is then financially and basically responsible, has a legal authority over the child, but also financial authority. So in other words, the father, although the children will live with the mother because the mother has the custody, the father remains to be legally responsible for the children legally, and that's perhaps making decisions about the academics, about some sort of even medical procedures, for example. So legally they're responsible for the child, but they're also financially responsible. It means they have to pay for the children's education, children's medical expenses, accommodation, housing, transportation, and all that. And so basically the guardian still has a responsibility, the guardian being the father, has responsibilities until the child is more or less sort of self-sufficient for boys and for girls until they're either married or employed. So this is another very interesting aspect that we've been consulted about in our practice, and that is... So guardianship, this is the legal obligation, right? We had the custody that ends at the age of 18, and there's now you have guardianship. So this is a legal responsibility or authority over the child. And so as per this, the new law, the guardianship basically ends over the boys when the boy becomes self-sufficient. So let's say the boy at the age of 16 decides that, or 18, that he's self-sufficient. So basically the guardianship can arguably be, can end. And in other words, that the father is no longer responsible to fund the child. That's if he's self-sufficient. And for the girls, it's when the girls are either married or employed. And so this is very important because the marriage part we knew and that existed before. So basically the father continues to be the guardian of the girl until she gets married. But now as per this law, he is the guardian of the girl until she gets married or she gets a job and she's employed. So if she is employed, then basically guardianship ends. And so this is quite another one of the sort of fundamental changes in the law that has been quite has met with a lot of positive and kind of excited attitude. So now with regards to documents, and this is another one of these, especially when you live in the Middle East, where so many families have so many different geographical bases that they kind of go back and forth between, is that you'll get documents. There's most people in the UAE who live in the UAE travel frequently. So either travel home to one parent's country or the other parents, or see grandparents yet another place, and so on and so forth. So having access to documents, the travel documents in particular, and passport in particular, is obviously a lot more relevant here than in some other countries where children often don't travel very much outside of the country until they're finished school or university. So under the new law, the guardian, the father, this would be by default, keeps the passport. But the custodian keeps like Emirates IDs and birth certificates and can also hold the passport for travel. But sort of the default right is with the guardian or the father for the passport in particular. The court can, however, override and assign to certain documents to the custodian, the mother in this case, especially if the guardian continues to withholds the documents kind of unreasonably. So in other words, that's a specific example of, passports. Is that we, because the passport sits with the guardian, if the mother wants to travel with the children, she cannot leave the country because the passports are with the child, with the father, with the ex-husband. And so we see a lot of cases where the mother asks for the passports and the father just sort of either kind of does not cooperate or is just unavailable. And so becomes an issue for the children to be able to travel with their mother. So if there's enough times these kinds of issues will arise between the parents with regards to transferring the children's passports, the court actually can issue a decision and mandate that it's that the passport should reside with the custodian, the mother, and not the father. But as a legal guardian of the children, the father is still responsible for kind of all the renewals of the passports and all the issuance costs. And so anytime there's anything that needs to be updated with regards to the passports or the Emirates ID or the visas, the responsibility is with the father. Okay, now let's kind of finish up the custody discussion on the loss of custody. I've mentioned this earlier, but so custody can be lost or it can be revoked. And that's if the custodian is incapable or negligent. We talked about that. So obviously this is a little subjective, but if there's enough evidence exists that the mother is incapable of taking care of the children or is negligent, so she can lose her custody. And similarly, if for some reason the custody is with the father, equally so the father would. So by the way, this particular provision in the law does not limit this custodian role to the mother. It's sort of gender neutral, but it's just that in most cases custody will be with the mother. But it's equally so that we've seen cases where custody for one reason or another also gets transferred to the father. So this particular provisions I'm about to discuss, they do apply to both parents. So obviously custody can be revoked if custodians are incapable or negligent. Or the custodian lives with someone who previously lost custody. So that also is one of the grounds for revoking or losing custody. Or that the custodian moves in a way that kind of affects the child's welfare. In other words, they physically relocate somewhere that becomes not in the interest of the child. Or if the custodian commits immoral behavior, that's another ground for losing custody. Or if the custodian, for example, does not claim custody for more than 1 year. So that sometimes also happens. So there's custody can be lost by default. Or if there's any other legal other requirements for custody are no longer met, that's also, whatever they might be, kind of the catch-all provision. That also can lead to loss of custody. But equally so, custody can be restored if any of these issues are resolved. So this is quite important because, let's face it, you know, when couples go through divorces or separation, there's a lot of emotions that run wild often, and people make act and erratically, and since that's kind of guess functional being of human and being emotional. So it may be that sometimes during these times there's one or the other parent who wants to claim custody can claim that, in particular, the father claim custody. For example, the mother is not fit to take care of the child because of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So the law is quite understanding, I guess, of the dynamics of family relationship, and as a result, sets out a very clear provision that custody can easily be restored if any of these issues are resolved. So, you know, in other words, if let's say the mother can now show that yes, I'm able to take care of my child, so she has all grounds to reclaim custody. Now, with regards to legal guardianship by the father, you know, as I mentioned earlier, it comes with responsibility, and that is that the fathers remain to be responsible for supporting children financially. So the father's obligated to, you know, they have to support girls until, I mentioned before, until they're either married or employed. So, in other words, to drive that point even further, so if a girl, even if it's a UAE national, if she reaches the age of 18 and she has a job and she wants to live and elsewhere on her own, the law allows her to do so. And then for the boys, as I mentioned earlier, the guardianship, the father's obligation to financial support a boy ends when he can help himself or sort of take care of himself financially. But with regards to disabled children, then guardianship remains forever. So it's indefinite. In other words, the father, if there is out of marriage, comes out any sort of disabled children, then the father's obligation to continue to provide financially remains indefinitely. So I think this is, again, the focus here is on the child's welfare. As we know, that those, you know, the families with children who are disabled, there's quite a bit of burden on the family, you know, emotional, psychological, and financial. So the law makes very clear that, you know, this is in such cases, it's not basically couples, or I guess there's no chance to kind of play these sort of court tactics to try to make it more difficult. So by default, doesn't matter what. The father may or may not argue, he remains responsible for financially supporting his disabled children until indefinitely. So now there's a provision in the law about, so finished custody, now there's alimony to the wife. Now, alimony is still, so there is, there is some provision in the law, but much of sort of alimony discussion is perhaps based more on sort of court precedents and judicial decisions in terms of how alimony is calculated. But generally speaking, as per the law, the husband must support the wife. So there's this expectation that irrespective of the woman's financial or employment status, it's the obligation of the husband during the marriage is to sort of financially also support his wife. And that, by the way, applies not just upon divorce. So this is quite, specific or nuanced or unique for the UAE, for the region. But basically, perhaps it's more based on the principle of Sharia, is that during the marriage, the husband has obligations to the wife. So he has to financially support her. And that is irrespective of how much money she makes, whether she has a job, you know, whether she's well-to-do, whether she came from a lot of money. So there's still, as part of the marriage, the husband has the obligation to take care of, financially take care and provide for his wife. That's his obligation. And if he doesn't, that basically gives grounds for divorce. And alimony in this case includes food, housing, healthcare, education, and just customary expenses. So, and this, by the way, we see quite a bit of cases where, you know, clients reach out to us and saying, listen, I'm married still, and I'm a stay-at-home mom, but my husband does not provide for me. He doesn't give me any money. Well, that is against the law. So that's, first of all, in addition for it to be a spousal abuse, It's specifically against the law because the law clearly sets an obligation on the husband to provide for the wife, and not just provide minimum, but it's, you know, as I said, food, you to sustain herself, housing, healthcare, education, and customary expenses, you know, expected of your family, you know, that particular status. So, and if he fails to pay, you know, more than 30 days, then that also gives grounds for divorce, a legitimate divorce. So that's the alimony to the wife. And now with regards to, now we're talking about, so coming towards the end of our happy marriage, and that's, you know, usually divorces. So, and specifically asset division. So there's a new concept in the law, which now allows for, in most cases, the wife, or for the wife to sort of contribute to request compensation reimbursement for her contributions to marital assets during the marriage. Even if it's not specifically in her name. So traditionally, historically, upon divorce from Muslim couples or those who are divorced under the UAE personal status law, which are based on principles of Sharia, so whatever is yours is yours, whatever is mine, so there's no division of assets per se. So in other words, if that particular property that the couple had bought is in the name of the husband, then the wife has no rights to it. Now, there's a new provision in the law that suggests that now if let's say the wife can show that she contributed to this overall sort of, I guess, value of this particular property. Let's say she helped find the property. She worked with a real estate agent. She helped redecorate it or fix it up or update it. She helped rent it out and manage renters and otherwise basically sort of help kind of increase the value of the asset. If she can show that, so we're not talking about financial contribution. If she can show that, then she's able now to request compensation for a contribution into that property. Now, so she's not claiming interest in the property. There's not the share in the property, but rather her contribution to the value of the property. And so in the law specifically states the contribution can be financial. Okay, so that's easy enough, but also intellectual and kind of managerial, like managing rental properties, and time and effort. So this is a new concept. It will be very interesting to see how the courts actually apply it, but it didn't. It is a groundbreaking provision because it didn't exist before. So now, and we have a lot of divorces that we handle where we see exactly that, where the couple comes and, you know, it happens so that after 20 years of their marriage, all the assets, in particular real estate assets, are still, or even business assets, by the way, are still in the name of the husband. But the wife said, "Listen, but I worked for his business. I helped. I was basically, I was a receptionist there. I would be there every day and I would respond to clients, or I came in and cleaned, whatever it may be." So she can show that she can contribute to her business, not just financially, but intellectually as well, and in terms of her effort and time. Then yes, now she can claim interest in that that specific asset, be it real estate, corporate asset, or whatever other sort of wealth asset that the family might have, or the couple, or I guess the husband, that would have title to. So this is really, really groundbreaking, and it will be very intriguing to see how the courts actually assess that value. I imagine they'll be appointing experts to determine and ultimately allocate some kind of percentage of the, you know, from the asset to compensate the wife for, you know, for her time and contributions towards the betterment of that asset. So very interesting concept. More to cover in the future as more details become available. Now, with regards to the type of divorce, now we've got three types of divorces. I think, remember, for the most part, we're talking about Muslim divorces. So one is talaq, which is the husband-initiated divorce. It existed before. The other one is hula, which is the wife-initiated divorce. And that's, you know, when she asks for a divorce and then by forfeiting her financial rights. And then now there's a third type of divorce, which is called tatliq, which is a court-ordered divorce. So this is a brand new provision. And it covers, without getting too into any nuances, but basically gives a very codified grounds for the court to divorce the couple. So it's no longer just that the husband, because kind of previously in the previous law, it's just mainly for the husband had if you will, more superior rights to ask for a divorce. And the wife, unless she wanted to waive all her financial entitlements, then basically she was kind of at the behest of the husband to grant her divorce in a way. So now there's a specific separate type of divorce, which is the court-ordered divorce. And so the court can order a divorce, and therefore when the court orders a divorce, then obviously it will still, the wife or the ex-wife will still have the financial benefits as if, let's say, if the husband had initiated divorce. So she would have the financial benefits from the divorce. Court can issue tatlik, again, that's the type of divorce, if the husband fails to provide for the wife at least 30 days. And that's what I described before, is that basically there is an obligation of the Sharia law for the husband to provide financially for the wife and not to keep her in some sort of despair, financial and mental. And so if he doesn't for more than 30 days, then that's ground for divorce, and the court will divorce and will grant compensation to the wife, right? Or if, for example, the husband claims insolvency for like more than 90 days, then as well, the court has grounds to divorce. And this is also great. It's important because now and we've seen this before, where the husband gets into issues, also financial difficulties, and the family sort of stranded, and the wife cannot even separate herself from these kind of legal debacles. So now the specific provision that allows the court to terminate marriage and grant the wife benefits of a divorce if the husband basically becomes insolvent. There's also one of the other grounds is that the husband fails to provide intimacy for more than 6 months, or, for example, if he fails to pay dowry, or if marriage is not consummated, is another grounds, or if there is substance abuse, or, and this is also important, if there's harmful illness, like mental or physical abuse. So this is huge because it didn't exist before, but I think this is quite important now, that if the wife can show that she's been abused mentally and psychologically and physically, then that gives now the court the right to divorce them without basically a husband's approval or consent to a divorce. And then, the final is ongoing marital harm. So again, if there's marital harm that's going on, then the court can use that to divorce the couple. Now, this is important because, under the kind of the old law, and often what we saw is that when the wife wanted to get divorced, she would file a talaq, for example, and the court would not grant it to her because it required the husband's approval. And the husband just refused approval, and the guest would torment the wife even further. And there wasn't really basically any other option other than to file for khula. Khula means you don't need approval from the husband, but you basically walk away from any kind of financial entitlements that you otherwise would be subject to. So now, as per this new type of divorce, which is tatlik, you have a whole list of grounds, as I've just covered, that now gives sort of control and the reins to the court to issue a divorce without depriving the woman of the financial benefits. Now, and then sort of the final aspect of the personal relationship is obviously this, the inheritance and the wills, and it usually comes upon death. For Muslims, inheritance is basically still the same as before, and that is subject to Sharia principle, which is, Muslims cannot will more than one third of their estate, and only to non-heirs. So in other words, Muslims, if let's say Muslim can only maximum will one third of their estate, but it must not be somebody who would otherwise be their heir. They cannot, a Muslim couple, the husband cannot issue a will for even one third of the estate to his wife because she's Muslim, so therefore she's his heir, and therefore that will is not possible. However, if the wife is not Muslim, then yes, he can issue a sort of will one third of his estate to her because under the law she's not considered as his heir. But even then, it can be so that's one third, the non-heir. Sometimes a husband can will more if, let's say, all heirs consent, or if there are no heirs, or if the spouse is the sole heir. But that does require a court process and fairly involved and quite difficult to actually have a will. But generally speaking, as I said, the wills to heirs are still not allowed unless everybody agrees and the court sort of signs off on it. And it has to be done under the court supervision. So in that case, wills are still limited for Muslims in the UAE, at least for UAE nationals. Now, as I say that, there's an option now for Muslim residents in the UAE to have a civil will, so not a religious will. So because what we're talking about here is basically a Sharia will, like a will for that applies to like a religious will. But it is now possible, particularly in Abu Dhabi, under the Abu Dhabi civil marriages law and its effects for Muslims who wish to have a non-religious will or a civil will, they now can have a civil will. And that basically takes away from this limitation of the one-third to a non-heir. But this applies only to Muslim non-resident, or Muslim residents and not Muslim citizens. And then so basically the final provision in the law is the one that deals with proving of lineage. And again, this is a lot more important and of a sort of a topic for discussion than one would think, but the DNA testing in particular. So the DNA testing is now a legal right, no longer requires proof of prior relationship, which was the case. So for example, let's say we've seen lots of cases where a woman comes and says, well, I have a child, and child was born to such and such a person. The father is that. And so in the past, you could not request for DNA test to be done unless you prove that you had a relationship with this man. But how do you prove that you had a relationship with this man to the point that that would result in a child? It's almost impossible to prove. So because it's not just a relationship per se, but it's a relationship. The evidence would have to show that that relationship would have necessarily led to a child, or for example, a confession. But now basically the law says the DNA testing is now a legal right. So then in that case, for example, a woman can file a case against this particular man and request for a DNA test to be conducted. And now it's no longer an option, and there's no really burden of proof for her to show that that DNA test should be done. Is that the court basically is obligated to order for that person to go through the DNA test. So I think this is a big shift in the law, and that sort of prioritizes scientific evidence over formalities, and obviously is very useful in disputes over parentage and sort of name registration and inheritance rights. So lots to cover, lots more in the law, and there's obviously a lot more nuances, but at a high level, we've just covered all sort of important aspects of the UAE personal law, and in other words, of sort of one's personal relationship. So that's all for this episode of Logical with Ludmila. If you find this episode useful and you like what we do, you can always find more on our website, which is lylawyers.com. We're also on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And for the full experience, you can watch our video podcast on YouTube. Until next time, stay informed, stay safe, and keep things logical.